It's very dangerous asking someone to present about something that they know a lot about, but I'll try to keep everything moving effectively. So this is a fascinating process, so I'm happy to share some of the expertise that I have. So this is a canonical process that we're talking about, and so the primary thing that we're focusing on here is what's involved in the canon law. What's the canon law aspect of this process? One of the things that is involved in this process, anyone who's been involved in it, is you realize that there's a lot of work involved with historians and theologians. A lot of theologians have to do a lot of work in studying the writings and the details of a servant of God's life. And historians have to do a lot of research into a servant of God. But fundamentally, this is a canonical process at its basis. So the scope of this presentation will be to focus on the canonical aspects of this type of investigation and this type of inquiry. And we will presume a certain familiarity with canon law. So the best this information is really best interpreted or understood by people with a background in canon law, people familiar with the contentious trial, the procedures that are used in a marriage nullity trial. So we'll make some references there periodically to annulments, to marriage nullity, and in particular to distinguish when the procedures that we use in this particular type of procedure, this type of process, when they differ from just the typical marriage annulment. So that'll be one of the things we'll try to set apart and distinguish. So first of all, just getting to basics, so where is it that we find the law that governs the diocesan inquiry, this work that we are talking about today? In the 1917 code, it was actually contained in the code itself, and so there were 143 canons that were part of the De Processibus, part of the procedural law of the church, that described in detail what was to be done in causes of beatification and canonization of servants of God and of blesseds. In the revision of the code, in the 1983 code, the decision was made to take that particular law out, and so it does not appear in the code with the exception of one canon. So people familiar with Book 7 of the Code may remember this one canon that just reminds us, Canon 1403, that special pontifical law governs causes of canonization of the servants of God. An interesting second paragraph to that canon does remind us that the prescripts of the Code, so we do appeal back to the Code of Canon Law whenever the special pontifical law refers to the universal Code of Canon Law, or when just by the nature of the matter we have to make use of those norms. So there are a few times at which that will come up. The actual legislation itself really does not ever make any reference to the Code of Canon Law, but there is an instruction that was issued that makes extensive reference to the Code of Canon Law, and mostly Book 7. So we are really comparing this to the contentious trial, to a typical annulment. There are many things where you'll hear very familiar things that will overlap as we go through. So where is this special pontifical law that was mentioned? So with the abrogation of the 1917 code, so in 1983 we have the new code, and with that came the new apostolic constitution. So this was promulgated in 1983. This is Divinus Perfectionis Magister. It is an appendix in the Code of Canon Law issued by the Canon Law Society of America, as well as the norms that are to be observed by bishops in carrying out inquisitions in causes of saints. So normae servandi, as they typically have that. So a lot of times when working in this area, you'll see DPM, a quick abbreviation for Divinus Perfectionis Magister. You'll see NS, Normae Servandi, the norms to be observed. And then I mentioned the instruction that came out. This is kind of our own little Dignitas Connubii. Just as tribunals got their special instruction to help in understanding and applying the law in marriage cases, so also there was an instruction in 2007 called Sanctorum Mater that was issued by the congregation. And that is really quite a helpful how-to guide. Anyone working in these causes is really well advised to pick up Sanctorum Mater, which is readily available, and follow that through. We'll walk you through many things step by step. A few extra things that might be worthy of some note are just a few smaller things. I put this in a smaller font because they're not necessarily as critical as the three sources I mentioned above. There are special norms on the administration of goods, of causes of beatification and canonization. Pope Francis, I think, as people are aware, wanted to make sure that money did not play an inordinate role and wanted to make sure that money was well cared for, so the goods that belong to a cause. And so there are some special norms that's issued in Italian, so which is understandable because it mostly regulates the funds that are held in the Vatican Bank. There's also in 2017 an apostolic letter, Maiorum Hac Delectionem. This is the famous new ground for canonization beyond martyrdom and beyond heroic virtue. This is the idea of the offering of one's life, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. It is a very new ground, and so far has really been untested, so it's still very much in a kind of a theoretical sense. We're kind of waiting to see the first cause that might come forward where we have a beatification canonization under that title, under that ground. And then there also in 2017 was a special instruction on relics. That also provided a lot of clarification whenever we're dealing with the mortal remains of a servant of God, the collection of relics, things like that. So a couple extra things, but we won't be spending much time on relics in particular or those administrative norms. Some of these items that I just mentioned are actually found on the website of the congregation. So this is just to give you a snapshot of the congregation's website. You'll notice that so it's causesanti.va, and under the section documenti or documents, you'll see these instructions. You'll see the whole thing. I wasn't able to fit the entire page on the screen, but if you were to scroll down on that page, you'll find everything from the Apostolic Constitution down to the most recent instruction. So a lot of material is available there, and you'll even notice with several of the links that a lot of that is even available in English as well as other languages as well. Material that is readily available to people who are in need to be able to consult those norms. It's perfectly available. This is a total shameless plug. Here it is. So, while I was working in the congregation from 2012 to 2015, I also worked on my doctorate and then finished the doctorate in 2015. I wrote actually on the Devil's Advocate. Okay, it's the boring title is to say the evolution of the promoter of faith, but the promoter of faith is more commonly known as the Devil's Advocate, and everyone perks up when I say that. That sounds interesting. Now all of a sudden, people are interested. The text is available, and so people are happy to share the fruits of that. The lengthy research involved for those with trouble sleeping, or those who need a little something extra boring, or those who need extra penance in their life, it's available there. So now to get a little more into the diocesan inquiry, they do refer to this as an inchiesta diocesana, and a diocesan inquiry, that's the term that they use. Sometimes we'll say investigation. I'll try to be consistent about saying inquiry. This would be also true if this was in one of the Eastern rites of the Catholic Church, if the Eastern Church is sui juris. This would be called an eparchial inquiry, so you will see that language very much as well. I'll probably just default to diocesan inquiry, but it always applies both to the diocese and the eparchy at the same time. If you're familiar with the typical annulment, you'll recognize that that the process breaks down more or less into three kind of distinct phases: the instruction, the evaluation, and the judgment. During the instruction, you're gathering proofs. During the evaluation, you're examining the proofs. That would be the evaluation of the proofs. This would be the judge's meeting. In a typical annulment, that's a very short step. It doesn't take a very long time. And then eventually the sentence is issued, and that would be the definitive judgment. So for an annulment, all of these things happen within one and the same tribunal. So it's one tribunal doing everything from collecting the proofs, evaluating them, and then pronouncing judgment. In causes of saints, this really happens in different ways. So when we talk about the diocesan inquiry, and this will be the majority of the presentation here, we're really talking about the collection of proofs. And that's really what the diocesan inquiry is all about. The evaluation of the proofs, that will happen in the congregation. So it's not really the responsibility or even the competence of those involved in the diocesan inquiry to evaluate or to say to Rome what they how these things should be evaluated. So Rome will evaluate that within the congregation, and that is not a quick process. That will take a lengthy period of time as the proofs that are submitted are studied. The lengthy and voluminous proofs, they are studied and scrutinized very carefully. And then finally, it's not even the congregation who pronounces judgment. Everything the congregation does is merely advisory to the Holy Father, and the Holy Father is the one who actually pronounces judgment. So all judgment in cases or causes of saints belongs to the Holy Father himself. So you'll hear a distinction between the diocesan phase, which is really the part about collecting the proofs, and that's distinct from the Roman phase after the inquiry has been sent over to Rome, at which it enters the stage of the evaluation of the proofs. So hopefully it gives a little thumbnail overview sketch of how this fits into a much larger process, a much more involved process than just this brief summary would make it seem. So now we delve into a little more in the diocesan inquiry. It's important for the people involved in the diocesan inquiry to understand what their job is. It's to collect proofs, but how do you know what proofs to collect? Well, you have to know what it is that is being that you're attempting to prove. What is it that needs to be examined? And so this is very helpful for those involved in the diocesan inquiry to really understand the object of their investigation. So in particular, we're looking for the proof of martyrdom or of heroic virtue, or with this new additional ground that's been added, this new additional way, the offering of life. So it is examining proofs of that which demonstrate that the servant of God is in fact worthy of imitation. And that's really what all saints are proposed for, is that we can imitate their example. They're held up for us as examples for us to follow, a sure path if we imitate their example that in fact is a sure route to eternal bliss and to a heavenly reward in company with those the blesseds and the saints who have gone before us. But in addition to that, we are also looking for evidence that the servant of God is also a sure intercessor. Those that are holy, then their prayers are heard, and so the thought is that the saints praying for us from heaven will intercede on our behalf, and so the answering of those prayers, miracles or graces or favors that are granted, those are traditionally seen as signs that confirm a divine confirmation of the church's judgment in terms of who to propose as a blessed or as a saint. And an additional detail, and this is maybe something that people might not take as seriously or might not realize just how important it is, but the sense of the reputation of the servant of God, this is really not to be underestimated. It's not enough just to show that they were a martyr or a virtuous person or that they made the offering of life, but is this a common reputation that's held among the faithful? So it's in addition to the proof of what they actually have done, and that is proof with moral certitude. That will be a familiar concept to canonical ears. But also you want to show that the faithful hold this opinion. The person has this reputation, or as they so often use the term in the particular legislation, the fama, the reputation of holiness, the reputation of martyrdom. The fact that that reputation exists and continues is actually seen as a work of the Holy Spirit inspiring the faithful. So that sensus fidelium is very, very alive and very present in this process, and it should never be overlooked. So that's always an important aspect to consider. So now let's get specific about these individual paths toward beatification and canonization. So, or what we might, what the person working in annulments might consider the grounds. So what are the grounds? If you're looking to annul a marriage, you have to know what ground is being examined, because it determines what questions you ask, determines what proofs you gather, and that's an important thing for the instructing judge to know. Well, here, these are what you might correlate to the grounds. So let's suppose that the person is being proposed as an alleged martyr. So then what must we prove? So the diocesan inquiry should focus in particular on demonstrating that the servant of God, and anyone whose cause has been opened is just called a servant of God. So that term is just a general term. So we'll use that as people who have been proposed for beatification and canonization. Did the servant of God, in fact, die a violent death? You have to demonstrate that. Was there, on the part of the persecutor, a real hatred for the faith? So martyrs are always persecuted. So you need to show the intentions of the persecutor, the one who is inflicting the death. And then also the martyr himself or herself must then voluntarily and freely accept death for love of Christ. And so you're looking for the attitude of the martyr, the attitude of the persecutor, and the fact of the violent death. And then don't forget, number four, don't forget the reputation. There must be a fama. There must be a reputation that, in fact, the person is a martyr and enjoys intercessory power. So another important detail not to leave out. If you're not dealing with martyrs, then you might be dealing with confessors, meaning those who have confessed the faith. This doesn't mean that priests who ordained and who hear confessions. This is a generic term. Someone who confesses the faith is in this in Causes of Saints is just simply called a confessor. So for someone who is proposed as a confessor, someone who practiced heroic virtue, it is necessary to prove not only the details about their life, but then in particular, the practice of all the theological virtues, of faith, hope, and charity, charity both toward God and toward one's neighbor, the practice of all of the cardinal virtues, which includes prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude, justice both toward God and toward one's neighbor, the practice of the virtues connected to one's state in life, and so this would be the living out of the evangelical counsels according to their state in life that they lived. So how did they embody poverty, chastity, and obedience? And then finally, the crowning virtue of humility is always added in, so it's customary to always include humility, which is an important characteristic. These examinations, these inquiries, have to probe in specific detail about each and every virtue. It's not enough to just say, oh, they was always faithful. Oh, he was never imprudent. That's not enough. You need concrete evidence of each and every individual virtue in the course of this investigation. Not only that, but the practice of these virtues has to be toward a heroic degree. So everyone can be virtuous for a time if they try, at least a little. But we are examining saints. This is most serious, and so we're looking for heroic virtue, something beyond the norm. And in particular, the custom within the congregation is at least to show that heroic virtue was present typically for the last 10 years of life. So you might have your St. Augustines who lived a less than a noble life at some point, but then from their conversion going forward, did they demonstrate heroic virtue? So you're looking for some extended period of time at the end of their life when they demonstrated that virtue. Don't forget the reputation. Furthermore, the presence of the fama, the reputation of the practice of virtue, and also of intercessory power. Those are all the elements that have to be included in a diocesan inquiry for heroic virtue. What about this new ground, the third way, this offering of life? Here it's necessary to prove, and this is drawing from the apostolic letter that was issued, it's necessary to prove that there was the free and voluntary offering of life, that a person was ready to offer or sacrifice their life, heroically accepting death for the sake of charity. The thing that that distinguishes the offering of life from martyrdom is that you don't have the odium fidei, you don't have the hatred on the part of the unjust persecutor. So this could be someone who volunteers to go into a situation where there's great illness or a plague, knowing that they most likely are going to contract the illness and die. A person is ready to, for the sake of charity, do something that in fact puts their life at great risk, and that they do so freely, voluntarily, and heroically. That's the distinguishing element. So they're not martyrs simply because the one element that you don't have is the persecution. You need to show, in addition to their intention to offer their life, that there was a certainty of death, that it was also occurred in a brief period of time. It's not enough to say that a person made an offering of life and 10 years later they died. No, it's a concrete, specific act related to a specific circumstance. And there has to be a connection, a nexus, as the apostolic letter says, between the offering made by the servant of God and their premature death, that this death came as a premature event because of their willingness to sacrifice himself. To quote the scripture, no greater love hath anyone than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. And that's the basis, essentially, of this ground. You do need to demonstrate that there is the practice of Christian virtue, at least to an ordinary degree. So this is distinguished from the confessors where you needed heroic virtue. Here you need the heroic acceptance of death. But when it comes to the practice of virtue, you need to show they were virtuous, but it need not necessarily be to a heroic degree. An ordinary degree of virtue is sufficient. What does all this mean? Well, we'll wait to see. We'll wait for an actual concrete case to see how these norms are interpreted. But this is how it's stated in the apostolic letter. And then finally, of course, never forget the reputation or the fama, so that they have the reputation of having offered their life heroically, and that they have the reputation of intercessory power. Since this is an untested ground, we do look forward to examples of interpretation of these requirements. We're waiting to see that put into practice, and so that will be a very interesting development, hopefully in the but not too long off into the future. Then finally, you might be asked to investigate a miracle. So there could be an alleged miracle that is put forward for a servant of God. And if that is the case, then you're looking to prove these elements. Number one, the lack of any natural explanation for a miraculous event. And then finally, number two, that there was the invocation of the servant of God. The concept is that the miraculous event, it has to be beyond all natural explanation. It's not enough just simply to say that this was an extremely rare disease. Only 1 in 1,000 survive. Well, 1 in 1,000 survive. That it might not be miraculous. This just might have been one of those lucky 1 in 1,000 cases. So even a 1 in 1,000 case is not good enough. It has to be something that defies scientific explanation, natural explanation, any ordinary explanation. And in the absence of natural explanation, there must be supernatural reason for this to have occurred, and that's the intercession. So it is important to show that someone prayed, that there was the prayer invoking the servant of God in this particular case. A miracle is not required if to beatify a martyr. Someone who is a martyr does not require a miracle for beatification, but a miracle is required in order to beatify a confessor, one who practiced heroic virtue, and a miracle is required in the case of the offering of life. So a miracle must be investigated in those two cases before beatification. And then in all cases, there must be a miracle that is presented and proven with moral certitude sometime after beatification in order to proceed to canonization. So that's kind of a quick overview of the objects of the diocesan inquiry. So now let's get into some of the details. And so this is practically speaking how a diocesan inquiry is carried out. First of all, you must have a petitioner. So let's talk a little bit about the petitioner. I'm referencing Norme Servandae, number one. You'll find this also in Sanctorum Mater in greater detail. So the petitioner is the person who is advancing the cause. Just like in an annulment, the petitioner petitions. He asks for the annulment. Here, the petitioner asks for the beatification and canonization. So who is the petitioner? Well, in annulment cases, it's an individual person. It's one of the parties in a marriage. Here, the petitioner can be a natural person. It can be an individual, or it could be a group of individuals. But they have to be in a position to guarantee the advancement of the cause, to carry it forward to its conclusion. This might take a long time. Causes sometimes run into years and decades and even centuries. So more often than not, it's probably more common that a petitioner is really generally a juridic person. A priest might be proposed for beatification, so the diocese might stand as the petitioner. A parish, so it could be the pastor who then stands as the petitioner in the case of a parishioner. A religious institute, if there is a religious proposed for canonization, very frequently it is their institute or their society who will actually serve as the petitioner. And it's always possible to create an association of the faithful that stands as the petitioner. It is not uncommon to have something like a guild or a foundation. In some cases you have things like the Fulton Sheen Foundation that stands as the petitioner, as the juridic person that's actually the petitioner in that case, just to give one example. Whoever wants to be the petitioner does have to be recognized as such by the competent bishop. We'll define that in just a moment. So they do have to be recognized, but once they're recognized, then they do have the right to pursue the cause. They have a responsibility to promote the cause, and they have a responsibility to pay for the expenses of the cause. That's the primary responsibility of the petitioner. The petitioner also nominates the postulator, and the postulator is the one who represents the cause. So the postulator would be very much akin to an advocate and procurator. So they are both a canonical expert, someone who's able to advise the petitioner, someone who represents the cause, someone who places acts on behalf of the cause. So that's why I say they're both an advocate and a procurator. They're described in Norme Servande, paragraphs 2, 3, and 4. The postulator can be anyone. It could be a priest, a religious, a layperson. It is generally expected that they should be an expert in theology, canon law, history, and the praxis of the congregation. Good luck finding someone who can be all of those things. In point of practice, rarely do you find all of those skills coming together in one person. And so it's enough that they at least have some exposure or at least some degree of knowledge of these matters. And there are resources available that the congregation offers. So there is material out there to help. I know that, and people who have worked on these causes, I know, are ready to be a resource to others who have to step into this role. But it does touch on a lot of issues: theology, canon law, history. In the Roman phase, there does have to be a Roman postulator, and that Roman postulator must be present in Rome because they are there to deal with the cause in front of the congregation. So sometimes you might have a diocesan postulator for the diocesan phase, might have a Roman postulator for the Roman phase. It is possible to choose a Roman postulator from the beginning, and then that Roman postulator, even while the cause is in its diocesan phase, the Roman postulator can nominate a vice postulator as a kind of a representative. And one reason to do this, if people are not knowledgeable about the process, it might be helpful to have the advice of a Roman and participation of a Roman postulator who can advise the vice postulator who can help that vice postulator to be effective in promoting a cause. So a Roman postulator is not required in the diocesan phase, but it is not uncommon that different causes will select a Roman postulator even from the beginning to help guide the cause. And a good postulator is really a tremendous asset to a cause, not to be taken lightly. So, the competent bishop, we mentioned that term, but let's define who that is. The competent bishop, this is not to say anything about his personal abilities or skills, this is purely canonical, so what defines him as canonically competent, this is the bishop of the diocese in which the servant of God died. That is what makes someone competent. Unlike marriage nullity, where you can have multiple titles of competence, a tribunal can be competent because of where the respondent lives, the petitioner lives, where the marriage took place, where the most proofs are. Here, there is only one title of competence: where did the servant of God die? If it has to do with a miracle, there's only one title of competence: where did the miracle occur? It's the diocese in which the miracle occurred. Competence can be transferred. So if it happens that one diocese, the bishop is competent in this case, but doesn't really know the person, or there's another bishop who would be in a better position to carry out the instruction, it can be transferred, and you write to the congregation, and the congregation can transfer competence. This is not the providence of the signatura. And incidentally, while we're at it, there is no recourse to the signatura. So unlike in other matters where you might take recourse regarding administrative acts, or you might ask the signatura for a transfer of competence, that does not happen in these cases. So the competence to do those things all falls with the Congregation of Causes of Saints. So now the introduction of a cause. Confessors, they must be studied individually. So whether they practiced heroic virtue or made the offering of life, you cannot do a group cause. You can't group them together and study them simultaneously. But you can group martyrs. So if you do have a group of martyrs, you can put them together in one cause. You can have one diocesan inquiry and one cause for Lawrence Ruiz and his companions, or just as an example. So it's always so-and-so, the lead person and companions. They have to have been martyred at the same, in the same period of time, in the same general place, and under the same persecution, because then you only prove the odium fidei of the persecutor. You only prove that one time, and then after that, then you go into the individual proposed martyrs and then just demonstrate their willingness to die for the faith. So you can group only causes of martyrs. You cannot group causes of confessors. People might ask in specific cases, and it has come up. So, for example, could the parents of St. Therese be treated together in one cause? The answer to that is no. So Louis Martin and Zélie Guérin, they each needed to be studied individually, so there were separate investigations for them individually as servants of God. But there was but when the miracle invoked both of them, they were both then beatified and canonized in the same ceremony. So a miracle could count for more than one person under those circumstances, but they do have to be studied individually. For martyrs, if you've got a group of martyrs, and sometimes this happens when you have the Spanish martyrs, the Korean martyrs, the Chinese martyrs, you may actually have people who died in multiple dioceses. You can group them together, but all the bishops involved must agree. So they have to agree to work together and to unite those causes under one title. And if the bishops agree, then you can do that. But even so, in the one diocesan inquiry, you do need to study the life of each individual servant of God. So it's still a lot of work involved. So many things that have to be examined. So the postulator, what is the postulator's job? To present the labellus. And now it's very familiar to canonists working in annulments. So the labellus starts the case off. It is the petition. So the postulator is the one who, on behalf of the petitioner, submits the labellus to the competent bishop asking for the instruction of the cause. One of the details that's mentioned here is that the petition, you can't present it until at least 5 years have passed since the death of the servant of God, but it should be presented within 30 years, and this is part of the reason. It's not explicitly stated quite this precisely in the law, but the idea is that sometimes when someone dies, there's a lot of excitement, and the question is this genuine? So one way to test that is to see if that reputation, if the devotion, if the excitement, will it last the test of time, or will the person be forgotten? So let it wait for 5 years, and let us test it to see if it is genuine. So you wait, generally speaking, that can be dispensed, but generally you wait at least 5 years. But if you wait more than 30 years, the congregation is going to wonder, has there been any attempt to delay until someone died, so that way we wouldn't have so many people raising objections. So there does have to be an indication that there was not a bad faith motivation for delaying in order to let a cause have more likelihood of success. So those are the questions that will come up if you try to introduce a cause too soon or if you wait too long. And causes can proceed. It's that it doesn't mean if it's more than 30 years that you have no hope. They can be taken up, but you need to explain the delay. So that needs to be accounted for. The postulator has more work involved. So the postulator, in addition to the labellus, must present a biography of the servant of God. A lot of times this would be 5 to 10 pages. So an ample biography, but doesn't have to include every single detail. A lot of times they have a chronology, to be honest. They'll put together a chronology of the life of the servant of God. The postulator must include all published writings. So any writings that the servant of God published. If someone came along and published the writings of the servant of God after death, that's not included in this item. This would be the things that the servant of God published. So things that would be publicly available, presumably the postulator can put his or her hands on those documents and must include them. The postulator also should include a list of witnesses who can testify about virtues, martyrdom, or the offering of life, as well as intercessory power. A postulator is required to submit contrary witnesses if there are some, so he cannot exclude them. And then just as a couple points here, if there are other writings of the servant of God, those are going to come up later in the process when the historical commission is appointed, and they'll do work in terms of gathering that. And then finally, just one last point, that oftentimes the postulator is going to, in fact, carry out some kind of a preliminary investigation. Even before the bishop has gotten involved, a postulator is going to talk with different people, gather a list of people who would have known the servant of God, begin to gather the story. So the postulator is presumptively in the best position to be able to put together this list of witnesses. And then the postulator must take an oath, and in that oath it's mentioned that the postulator is, in fact, not trying to hide or cover up anything that might not be favorable. So obviously the postulator wants the person canonized, but the postulator is still bound to present. If there is negative information, it cannot be hidden. A word about witnesses. So the congregation uses terminology to talk about first-hand, second-hand, or third-hand witnesses, sometimes using the idea of first-degree witnesses, second-degree, or third-degree. You'll hear those terms used. So first-degree witnesses are eyewitnesses who knew the servant of God in person, in life. You must hear those witnesses. If you have those witnesses, they really must be included. If it's a ridiculously large number, you have to make some selections, but if it's eyewitnesses, really must be included. Second degree witnesses, second hand, those who have heard from first hand witnesses, those are called hearsay witnesses. They may be heard, so they may have valuable information. It is less direct because they did not know the servant of God as personally. So you may include them, but then third-hand witnesses, meaning people who have heard from people who have heard, but where the source of the information is not, you can't trace back to first-hand. Third-degree witnesses, it's not foreseen. That information becomes too corrupt. They don't have as much information to give. So that's the general sense of witnesses and who really is first and must be heard and who can be heard and all that. If you have living eyewitnesses, then it is considered a recent cause, and so you will work mostly with witness testimony. That's going to be the crux of the case. But if it happens that you don't have any eyewitnesses, if there are no living eyewitnesses, they call that an ancient cause. And here the primary proof is going to come in the form of documents. So the documentary evidence is going to be more critical. There are still witnesses. You ask for witnesses in order to testify to the fama, the reputation. So never forget the fama, that reputation of holiness, and that must be present. That must continue even to the present. So witnesses can testify at least to the ongoing reputation. So the steps in the inquiry, so if the bishop then decides to accept the petition, so far we've only gotten to the petition. So we've done all this work and we're just at the petition. The bishop can decide to accept the petition, but before he decides this, if he does decide to accept it, he is interested in taking up the cause, he begins some consultation. He consults with the other bishops of the province or of the country. He issues an edict to publicize the petition and invites the faithful to come forward. And he also consults the Holy See. So these are all three groups of consultation: consulting with the hierarchy, consulting with the faithful, consulting with the Holy See. The Holy See will examine the different records that might exist in the various dicasteries of the Holy See to see if they have any information. Generally speaking, the Holy See will not tell you that this is a good candidate for canonization. They will only tell you if there's a problem. So if there's some damnable fact that may not be widely known, but if it's in the archives of one of the dicasteries, then that will be made known that there is an obstacle. So there'll be an obstat, and it's to save the bishop a lot of work. So so why start a case if basically you know it has no hope of going forward? So that nihil obstat from the Holy See is very advisable. Ask for that early. Save yourself the work, even though it's not likely that that will create an obstacle, but just in case. Hearing the faithful, this really is an important moment. This is a time to let the faithful come forward. So that edict is more than just simply saying we're opening the cause. If anybody has any information, this is now a speak now or forever hold your peace. This is an opportunity. If you have something, if you know something, come forward. So this is the time to speak. That's an important part of the edict. That's part of the motivation for the edict. So then we have published writings of the servant of God. There are two theological censors who need to be appointed, two theologians. So generally speaking, people holding degrees in theology, they must examine the published writings of the servant of God for doctrinal error. If there is an error, if there's a problem in faith or morals, that could be a reason that would block a cause. Because you can't propose someone for imitation if in fact they taught heresy or some grave error. So you look at their published writings for sure. They may look at non-published writings, depending on the circumstance, that might be advisable. And if there are no errors, so this is almost a negative step in the process. You're proving that there is not an obstacle. If there is no obstacle, then the case, in fact, can go forward. So it's not a guarantee. A person could be quite a nice, quite a good spiritual writer, but might not be a very virtuous person in real life. So just the fact that they could write well is not a guarantee alone. A couple errors that sometimes come up. I see sometimes that the two censors are nominated to compose the quote-unquote theological commission, and there really is no such a thing as a theological commission, because the concept here is that they do not work together. They don't work as a team. It was part of the traditional process that, in fact, they wouldn't even know who each other was. They were to offer their own opinions with no collusion with the other theologian, but offer their own opinions on the various works of the servant of God, making sure that there's no problem. In the case of a very large number of writings, you can choose more than two censors and just make sure that things are divided up so you do get two independent opinions about each writing. I know in the case of Fulton Sheen, he wrote a lot. And so that was one of the times this was invoked, to allow for multiple censors to be involved, so that way it wouldn't fall to just simply two people to have to read everything and delay the cause. And the censors, they offer their private opinion. They're not known to each other, nor are they, generally speaking, publicly announced. So you do not call them as witnesses. You do not ask them to testify. That's another mistake I sometimes see in these cases. Then the historical commission, so the historians, they have to be appointed in order to gather documentary evidence. They go to archives, they investigate wherever documents might be found. Oftentimes they would be experts as historians or as in library science or in archival science or something like that. That's the typical historical expert. You need at least three. And they do work together. They do form an actual commission. This is a true commission where they are working together. And so the experts must gather the documents. They must write a report. And they must also testify. They testify about the authenticity of the documents and what their impressions are. So they do compose one report that they put together in solidum. They prepare this essentially one common report that they all sign. And they do testify about the work that they did, that it was thorough, complete, nothing was altered or mutilated, and they offer their thoughts or their opinions from what they have read about the life and the personality of the servant of God. So they can be quite helpful, especially in an ancient case. Their work is critical to get that documentation together. So now we've done theologians and historians, and now we're finally up to the tribunal of inquiry. We're ready for witnesses. So the bishop appoints the members of the tribunal of inquiry, and that oftentimes is the term that you'll use. They are considered a tribunal. So you'll hear that term thrown around. And every one of them must swear an oath. So they have to be appointed. They swear an oath to faithfully execute their duties. This includes three people, or at least three people, an episcopal delegate who carries out the investigation, a promoter of justice, and then a notary, and there can be adjunct notaries to assist with this. Norme Servandi, number 6. If it is a miraculous healing, you do add another expert. This is like a court expert, like the tribunal might call upon a psychologist in a 1095 case. Well, here you call upon a medical expert or a technical expert or someone who can, in fact, advise the tribunal regarding the nature of the miracle that is proposed. So in miracle cases, you do add that additional person to the tribunal of inquiry, and they take part in all the sessions. The episcopal delegate, promoter of justice, must be priests. They must be experts in canon law, theology, and history. Good luck finding someone expert in all of those. You work with the best that you can. Oftentimes, I think canonists are chosen because it does have the form of a canonical process, and so oftentimes canonists are best qualified to carry out this work. Everyone must have a letter of appointment. They must have an oath upon assuming office, an oath upon completing office that they have faithfully done their duty. All of this is marked with a seal. This includes censors and historians. They need letters of appointment, oaths, all signed and sealed. So the paperwork on this is, it's important that all of that be present. Here's a theoretical point about canon law. It's a principle of law. So it's the principle of sometimes what they call the three in judgment, that whenever you have a case, you must have someone who is for the case, for the cause, someone who stands against the cause, and then you have the judge who is impartial and who stands in the middle. So you cannot, in fact, have a contradictorium or the confrontation, that judicial confrontation, unless you have the for and the against, pro et contra, and then the one in the middle, the one who judges. So who is pro? Who is for the cause? That's the petitioner. petitioner wants the canonization, and the postulator. The postulator is advocating for the canonization. So who is the objective and impartial parties? Well, the diocesan bishop is to remain as an impartial figure. The theological censors and historical experts, they must remain impartial, so they evaluate the writings and gather the documents in an impartial way. The episcopal delegate is like the instructing judge. Examining the witnesses must remain impartial. Notaries must remain impartial. So here's my question. Who stands in opposition? Who is the contra? Who stands against? Creating this true contradictorium. At the risk of droning on, this is part of why I wrote the thesis that I did for the doctorate. So where is the devil's advocate? This traditional promoter fiscalis, which is the old term that was used, that eventually morphed into, in criminal cases, the promoter of justice is the one who stands against the accused. The defender of the bond is the one that stands against the annulment and defends the marriage. And traditionally speaking, they would say the promoter of faith in causes of saints is the one who is the devil's advocate, who proposes obstacles, who raises questions, who examines doubts. And so my recommendation is that in the diocesan inquiry, I think the promoter of justice is the one best suited to play this role. And the promoter of justice, in fact, should remain vigilant regarding the observance of the law and also the search for the truth. These are the two things. This is expressed in the legislation that the promoter should, in fact, see to the observance of law and the search for the truth. My suggestion, my recommendation, is that he be considered as a kind of devil's advocate. If there's an objection to be raised, he should be attentive and be ready to raise it. So there's my end of commercial for the doctoral thesis there. So that's my recommendation. Even though not explicitly stated in the law, I think that's the best way to proceed. So the duties of the promoter of justice. So the promoter now gets everything that you have so far. Ideally, this would be the theological censor's opinions. This would be the biography and the writings that were submitted by the postulator. This would be the report from the historians. They get everything. And the promoter then has to compose the interrogatory. This is an important step because the interrogatory should be designed in a way that searches for the truth. It should be comprehensive. It should examine all the elements of the case. It should be ready to look not only just for the virtues, but also for the vices. It should examine everything. So the interrogatory is so important. It's because this is what's going to shape the hearing of the witnesses. And so it is actually the promoter of justice, not the episcopal delegate, but the promoter who composes the interrogatory. The promoter is also to call some witnesses ex officio. So how does the promoter know who to choose? The promoter should be on the lookout to see, was anyone missed? Was there someone obvious who should be heard? Is there anyone who might be against the cause? Is there anyone with something negative to say? Or, in fact, can we just simply test the cause and see, does this reputation for holiness, does it persevere and is it trustworthy? So the promoter has to choose two witnesses typically, but can choose more. But it is the promoter's job to choose at least some ex officio witnesses. You might call this a counterbalance to the postulator. So the postulator presents witnesses, so does the promoter, so that both sides, in fact, have a chance to be heard. So this is all part of that idea of the devil's advocate, serving as the contrarian here of this case. For the interrogatory itself, there is a textbook that the congregation publishes, so Le Causi dei Santi. It's currently in its fourth edition in the Vatican Publishing House, issued in 2018. It's actually on the table right behind me, so this is the fourth edition of this particular text. And in it actually has some proposed interrogatories that are presented. It's all in Italian. And so the congregation has a proposed set of questions of 35 questions. You can say, well, that doesn't sound very bad. Only 35 questions? Yes, but it's 35 questions, each of which is broken down into multiple parts. So it is an extraordinarily thorough questionnaire. If you were to break the questions up individually, causes oftentimes will pose more than 150 questions to each witness, every witness, oftentimes. Sometimes if it's the idea of martyrdom or a miracle case, maybe there will be fewer questions. But especially when you're going through virtues, it is a long questionnaire, and it must be detailed. And let's talk a little bit about some of those questions. Here's just a brief clip from the Vatican website for Causes of Saints. And they do, in fact, describe this book and how you might obtain it. It is, in fact, the textbook for a studium that the congregation offers. If people are interested in getting into more detail, they actually do run a course. It is a course that is offered that teaches people about causes of saints. If you want to be a postulator or an official working on a cause, or if this is the type of work that you would want to do, it's open to anyone who's interested in registering for that class. So here from the congregation's textbook, here are some of the things you should include in the interrogatory. The witnesses should make an oath to tell integrally and completely, including favorable and unfavorable information, and to observe secrecy. Observing secrecy is to prevent them from colluding with other witnesses. So they're not to tell another witness, oh, here is what I was asked. They're not allowed to share the questions with other people. So that way each witness is in fact giving their own personal candid information. So the witness, tell me about yourself, your background, your connection to the servant of God, and how you know the servant of God. Tell me about the servant of God, their family, childhood, education, religious practices, vocational formation, if they're a priest, a religious, a bishop, if they're married, if they were living a single life. Give us the details of their major life events, their personal characteristics, their devotion, their religious activity. There's a lot that's there. The death of the servant of God. So explain to me the condition of health, the cause of death, the final illness, and then also their perseverance in the faith, their place of burial. So details, very thorough details about the life and death of the servant of God. If it's a martyr, and we need to know about the persecutor, their hatred of the faith, the response of the servant of God, their disposition to accept martyrdom, the opinion about the reputation that was held about their martyrdom at the time of their death and after death. In the case of the offering of life, this is that untested ground so far, but we'd certainly want to examine the circumstances leading to their premature death, their willingness to accept death, the connection between their offering of life and their and the death that they suffered, the practice of the individual virtues, since the virtues are to be examined to at least an ordinary degree, so we do need to ask about the virtues. And now for the confessor, if it's a case of heroic virtue, ask in specific detail for concrete moments in life in which they practiced each of these virtues. It's not enough to be generic. It must be specific. How, when, where did they demonstrate the virtue of faith, hope, charity toward God, charity towards one's neighbor, prudence, justice, justice towards God, justice towards one's neighbor, fortitude, temperance, obedience, poverty, chastity, humility. The degree of virtue that they practiced, was it of a heroic degree? The graces and charisms that they demonstrated in life. And then finally, their reputation. Never forget the fama. The reputation of holiness that they had in life, at their death, and increasing after death. And then in all cases, the continuation of that devotion among the faithful. Are there any graces attributed to their intercession? Do they have the fama, the reputation for intercessory power, as well as their own holiness? So as you can imagine, that's quite an interrogatory. And it really does need to be tailored because every servant of God is going to have unique moments in life. So the questions are going to have to be adapted. In miracles, they very much need to be adapted. So depending on the nature of the miracle, so what was it that happened? So questions that would be very appropriate after asking about the identity of the witness, to ask about then in terms of the cure that was experienced, the person who was cured, examine their family health, their history, the patient's personal history of health, even psychiatric health, which may be relevant. Ask about the disease, the symptoms, the tests, the diagnosis, the prognosis, the treatments that were administered, the medications that were administered, any surgeries performed, hospitalizations, any treating physicians and specialists, who were they and what was done? What were the opinions of the medical experts? What was the expected outcome that they told after they received their treatment? A complete chronology of the disease, the illness or the trauma, whatever it happened to be. Then we need a proof of intercessory prayer. So that needs to also be a part of this investigation. Who prayed? How did they pray? Where did they pray? Did they say novenas? Did they use relics or medals or holy cards? Was there a visit to the tomb or to the place of the servant of God or the invocation of other saints? The invocation of other saints, this is a tricky one because if a person was praying to everybody under the sun, then unfortunately that can create a big problem because how do I know that the servant of God was the one who answered the prayer? If you prayed to the servant of God, Fulton Sheen, and also at the same time to St. Anthony, well, maybe St. Anthony answered the prayer rather than Fulton Sheen. So it is important to show that there was a unique invocation of the particular servant of God, or that you could identify that there was something primary about that particular servant of God. So so that even asking about who else was prayed to is actually important. And then once the healing itself occurs and you're connecting the healing with the intercessory prayer, then what's the state of health after? We need medical documentation, the opinion of medical experts, and also their thoughts regarding whether or not there is a natural explanation. So quite a detailed interrogatory, not quite as detailed as the heroic virtues, but definitely a detailed interrogatory. So now we're ready to open the session. Okay, this is all preliminary. So, one thing I should say at this point is that the instruction kind of presumes that the theologians are going to go do their work and historians are going to do their work, and you're going to wait to hear witnesses until after that's all done. That's the norm. That's what's envisioned by the law. But in point of fact, what oftentimes will happen is these things will happen simultaneously. So you may have an opening session in which you go ahead and get started with the hearing of witnesses while at the same time the theologians and the historians are doing their work. So that may be simultaneous in practice, but it's not, the legislation does not anticipate that it's not described that way. Whenever we're ready to start hearing witnesses, the bishop holds an opening session. The opening session or the first session of the tribunal is to swear oaths. So all of their letters of appointment are presented. They all swear their oaths. Everything that's been gathered up to that point is introduced into the acts. That session may be held in public, and then that's the beginning of the tribunal. The episcopal delegate, the promoter of justice, and the notary are now ready to begin. So they now begin holding sessions for the individual witnesses. The episcopal delegate is like the instructing judge. The episcopal delegate leads the session. So all of the witnesses, you must cite them to come to the tribunal to be examined. The promoter of justice must be cited. It's important to cite the promoter of justice so the promoter is able to participate and take part. But the postulator must never be cited. This is an important distinction. Usually in tribunals, in marriage nullity cases, if you have the advocate for the petitioner and the advocate for the respondent, they both have a right to be present, not here. This is an error that some authors had written about, assuming, oh, of course the postulator can be present. Oh, of course the postulator can suggest questions. But the congregation clarified in 1999, this is an example of where the bias is in favor of the devil's advocate. So lest the postulator influence the case too greatly, the postulator cannot take part. The postulator cannot be informed of the questions, lest there be any collusion or any plotting or planning in order to deceive the tribunal. So the postulator is expressly excluded from these sessions and cannot be there ad validitatem. So just be aware of that detail. And that was clarified in an actual decision in a plenarium of the congregation in 1999. After each witness swears their oath, the episcopal delegate asks each question from the interrogatory. Ex officio questions can be inserted by the episcopal delegate, either on his own or at the suggestion of the promoter of justice, or in a miracle case, perhaps at the suggestion of the medical expert. The medical expert can also recommend questions, and in fact should do so, to clarify the medical evidence that is being obtained. So although this is not found in the 1983 code, the congregation still tends to use the expression of sessions. A session has a beginning and an end. So if you're gathering to hear a witness, you have a session. You begin the session, you convene the witness, you ask the questions, you close the session. Everything that is gathered by way of evidence is done in a session. This is envisioned to be done in person, so in person with the notary present. This is not a questionnaire that's sent out in the mail. If people are familiar in tribunals with the idea of, well, we'll just send out the questionnaires and let the people answer them and send them back, do not do that. That will not work. That will be thrown out by the congregation. So it is envisioned that you would have an in-person session with the episcopal delegate, with the promoter of justice, with the notary, and with the witness present there and answering the questions. The promoter of justice must be cited for every session. I mentioned that before. If the promoter was not cited, then at least he should be present. But if he was not cited and he was absent, that session is invalid. This is a very serious, it just shows the seriousness of making sure the promoter is present. So if the promoter is cited but he was absent, he can examine the acts after the fact, and that is acceptable. So that does not invalidate the process. But if he was not cited and he was absent, that invalidity cannot be remedied later by him examining the acts. So be careful about that point. So the participation of the promoter is a very important important detail. So a variety of witnesses should be heard. This is an important detail for postulators when presenting witnesses. You want to hear a variety of people, relatives, non-relatives, clergy, religious, laity. You want a little bit of everything. The more variety you can have from your witnesses. If you hear only one group of witnesses, if someone's proposed and all you hear from are priests but no lay people, then the congregation will ask. He says, well, don't any lay people have any opinions about this either? Or if it was all lay people and no clergy, they will wonder, well, didn't the servant of God know any clergy who had an opinion? Especially in religious orders, this is one where you want some members of the religious order, and you want some members not of the religious order. It's a very important thing that you get a variety of witnesses. Ex officio witnesses are oftentimes heard last. These are the ones the promoter recommends. It's presumed that the postulator is probably going to present favorable witnesses insofar as possible. So the promoter should be alert to any potential negative witnesses, and that's where the promoter can present ex officio witnesses, can even, in the middle of the investigation, can add, I'd like to add an ex officio witness, if we want to make sure that there isn't another opinion out there that should be heard. If you're moving about, you might be hearing witnesses from all over, maybe outside the bounds of the diocese. Do follow the canons on functioning in another territory. So normally, if your authority is only within the diocese where you were appointed, you do need the permission of a bishop to function in another diocese. And there's some information about having a rogatory if you want another tribunal constituted to hear witnesses in another diocese. Anyway, so there are a few technical things there, but just be attentive to the rules about hearing witnesses outside of your territory. So that canon 1469 is helpful. In recent causes, it is not unusual to call 50 witnesses to whom you may have to ask 150 questions. This is serious stuff. If it's an ancient cause where you have no eyewitnesses and the witnesses are just testifying to the fama, to the reputation, there you might have perhaps 12 witnesses. That would not be unheard of, because the proof in an ancient cause is mostly going to center on documents. If it's miracles, the number of witnesses is going to depend. You want to hear the medical experts, the medical people, and you want to hear the people who prayed. You have to hear about the intercessory prayer, and you have to hear about the medical evidence or whatever is the, whoever would have the knowledge of the miracle itself. So their number of witnesses is going to depend. In the Sheen miracle case, I want to say that there were, I believe there were around 15 witnesses, and it was a mix of devoted people who prayed, and it was a mix of nurses and doctors who were knowledgeable of the treatment of the child who was resuscitated after a long period without heartbeat or respiration. Special issues for religious orders. I already mentioned that you want witnesses both from inside and outside the institute. That's important. But you are allowed to choose a historical expert from the same order, but you're not allowed to choose anybody else. So if it's a Jesuit servant of God, you cannot choose a Jesuit Episcopal delegate. You cannot choose a Jesuit promoter of justice, or a notary, or a theological censor. You can choose a Jesuit historian who could help in the gathering of evidence. And the postulator, of course, in that case, would be a Jesuit, the postulator general. So be aware in religious cases that they can be a postulator or one historical expert, but they cannot perform any other roles. In cases of miracles, I mentioned that there is a medical expert who can and should suggest additional questions. The witnesses need to include the person who was healed, the physicians, those who prayed, and also two inspection experts, two experts ab inspectione, they say. This means that the person who is healed needs to be examined by two different doctors who will then come in and write up a report and testify about the present state of health of the person who was healed. It's a little bit like the two censors. The two censors, they read all the theological writings and then make their own evaluations. Well, these two medical experts examine the person who was purported to be healed, and they make their reports. And oftentimes it's presumed that they don't necessarily know one another. They certainly do not work together. They are to be two independent experts offering their own personal and individual report about the present state of health. It's verifying that, in fact, the illness, disease, or whatnot has not reoccurred. That's the purpose here. There is also an important examination to make sure there is no unlawful cult. The norms to be observed, they just simply mention that the tribunal is to verify there is no unlawful cult, according to the decrees of Urban VIII, issued, I think, in 1634, if I remember right, 1634 and 1642. But then it doesn't say what is that unlawful cult. Well, here's what's constituted as unlawful cult. Unlawful cult would be things that you cannot do prior to beatification. Once someone is beatified, you can do all of these things. But prior to beatification, you cannot anticipate the judgment of the church. So after beatification, sure, say Mass and office in the person's honor, but not before. After beatification and canonization, sure, dedicate churches and chapels in that person's name, dedicate a church in their name, but not before. Mortal remains, sure, you can display the relics or the remains of a blessed or a saint under an altar, but not before. Displaying relics, reverencing them publicly, not before beatification. Even putting images of the servant of God in a church or a chapel with the signs of holiness, like decorating them with a halo or with the cloud of glory, the nimbus, or rays over their head. Do not do that before. You'll give the false impression that the church has already pronounced the person blessed. Publishing books about miracles, revelations, or graces, not before beatification. And decorations at the tomb, like testimonials, images, and votive candles, not before beatification. So those would be unlawful cult. I remember working on one case where, I was reading through the case, the Acts even kind of mentioned that people didn't seem to be all that devoted until the pastor of the parish put up a picture of the servant of God in heaven holding the Christ child. And then suddenly after that, there started to be greater devotion to the servant of God. Well, no kidding. So that was one where that was unlawful cult, and that picture had to be taken down, and that had to be remedied. And I don't know that that cause ever continued on. So it certainly ran into problems because they violated this principle. At the conclusion, so it is common to authenticate the mortal remains of the servant of God if it's known where they are. That's a step that is mentioned in the process. The acts then have to be published. So who gets to see them? The promoter and the postulator. This is their chance to examine them. This, in fact, is the first chance for the postulator to examine the acts. Up to this point, the postulator has not seen any of these acts, any of the witness testimony. But now the postulator can come in and see them, see what has been gathered, and if anyone is going to ask for any further instruction, this is their time to do that. The acts are copied, an original is kept in the diocese, two copies are sent to Rome. Everyone involved, if you're a copyist, if you're a translator, if you're a typist, everyone involved has to have a letter of appointment. They must take an oath and swear that they will, in fact, discharge their duties faithfully. The closing session, like the opening session, can be done in public, and everyone involved comes forward to swear those, again, that they have faithfully completed their duties. The acts are sealed, transmitted to the congregation, and while you can have a public celebration, this is not to be done with too much laudatory praise of the servant of God, lest, again, it seem to anticipate a beatification as a fait accompli. That's not to be done. Within the congregation, this maybe is just helpful, just really briefly, to touch on what happens in the congregation. When the congregation gets the acts, they will inspect the seal to find out if, in fact, they've been tampered with. It is important to be able to demonstrate that the acts have been untampered. So they have arrived in the congregation untampered. Once they open the seal, the congregation will examine the diocesan inquiry to determine if it was juridically valid. So were all of the laws followed? And the congregation, in fact, has the power to sanate any errors. And it's almost impossible to carry out an investigation without making some error, because the rules are so precise. So the congregation is somewhat patient in understanding of you know, maybe small things. But do follow the law carefully, because it can result, being too cavalier with these rules can result in the inquiry being thrown out and being declared invalid. Normally what the congregation will do is they will either say, so are we agreed upon validity in this case and for the effect for which it drives? They will say affirmative, yes, it is valid. Negative means the whole thing is thrown out, and they don't like to give negatives because that's a lot of work, and then it's if it's negative, you literally throw the whole thing away and start, say thank you, start over. What they oftentimes will do if there's a problem, they will give a suspensive judgment. And the suspensive determination says that there's a procedural defect or a substantial defect, so either in the observance of the procedure or, in fact, in carrying out the actual discernment of the investigation. So either procedurally there was maybe a small error, or, in fact, substantially maybe there's some larger issue that has to be resolved, and they will invite the postulator, in fact, to try to supply evidence if it can be done, or to carry out a supplementary inquiry, if necessary, to remedy the defect. And if possible, then they will give an affirmative once whatever defect has been remedied. After that, all of the acts are handed over to the Roman postulator, who works with a relator from the congregation to prepare the positio, the position paper. The positio is prepared in which the case is made. The proofs are gathered, witness testimonies are summarized, the documents are summarized, the argument is set out explaining the servant of God and why this person, in fact, should be considered a martyr, a confessor, or one who made the offering of life. And that is examined by historians, if the historians need to evaluate the historical evidence, doctors, who will evaluate the medical evidence in the case of a miracle, theologians, who will examine the theological aspects of the case. Always theologians are involved. And then eventually the cardinal and bishop members of the congregation themselves then finally make a vote, and their vote is merely advisory. It's still, in every case, it still is just an advice. It is their recommendation or their opinion in the matter. And all of these must pass with supermajorities. It's not enough to have 50% plus one. You must have a substantial number, substantial majorities, in order to pass from each phase through each step. And then these recommendations are put to the Holy Father, and he is the one who can declare the person to be a martyr, to have practiced heroic virtue as venerable, or to approve a miracle, to say that a miracle in fact has been proven. So the Holy Father, and those you'll sometimes see in the Bulletino where the Pope issues the promulgation of various decrees. That's when the Pope has in fact put his official approval recognizing these individual steps. Maybe just one last detail, and this is at the risk of droning on and wearing you out, but this last little detail is oftentimes one, when I bring it up, people get really fascinated by this. It is just a comment on the way in which the congregation has, and the church in general, has looked at different miracles. There are different classes of miracles, first, second, and third class. Most miracles examined by the congregation are third-class miracles. So they are the third category. And that's perfectly fine. The third-class miracle is perfectly fine. But this is just theologically and kind of traditionally speaking a little breakdown of the different levels of miracles. So what is a first-class miracle? It is something that affects the substance of a thing. So with respect to the substance, quod substantium. The substance of a thing, this is describing something that is metaphysically impossible. So an example of a first-class miracle would be multiplying bread. That is a physical impossibility, like the multiplication of the loaves and the fish. Changing water into wine, wedding feast of Cana. That is a physical impossibility. Raising the dead, that is a physical impossibility. There has been a substantial change. The person has died, and if you raise the dead, that is first-class miracle all the way. Second-class miracle is with respect to the person. Quod personam deals with the individual person for whom, in their case, a particular circumstance is impossible. The healing of the man with the withered hand. There is no hand there. And if the hand is suddenly restored, that is, in fact, something that is, it's not the repair of a damaged hand. It is, in fact, the restoration of something that was absent. The reappearance of an organ that was not present in the body would be another example. The healing of the man born blind, to use John chapter 9. that would be so someone who had never seen, that person had never seen. So for that person, that you're constituting an impossibility. So second class miracle. Third class miracle, this is a miracle with respect to the way in which the miracle occurred, quod modum. So in other words, a cure of this kind might be possible, but not in the manner or the mode in which it occurred. So can a person with cancer recover from cancer? Sure, after a lot of drugs, after chemotherapy, after radiation, after surgery, after treatment, after months of recuperation, can they be cured of cancer? Sure, we can find a natural way to do that. But if a person is cured of a large cancerous mass instantaneously, and it's a perfect cure, there's no cancer remaining, and the cancer doesn't come back, no one can explain that. That's an impossible way for it to occur. So most miracles are something that happens that is beyond natural explanation. Not that you can't help the person, but to do so in a way that is instantaneous, perfect, and enduring or lasting, that is the thing that makes the miracle inexplicable. And those are third-class miracles. So this is just an aside for Fulton Sheen, is that when the Sheen miracle is being examined, so I was told that the doctors were taking a long time, and this is generally not considered a good sign. If the doctors are going on for a long meeting, then you start to get worried. It's like, why is this taking so long? This should actually be a pretty slam dunk case. This was a case of a child who was stillborn upon birth, was healthy in utero, but then essentially stillborn on birth with no heartbeat or respiration, and continued for 61 minutes, not 61 seconds, but 61 minutes, without heartbeat or respiration until finally recovering signs of life, and then is grown up with a normal life with normal function. And that's really a remarkable thing. Well, apparently what the doctors were debating is this the third class miracle or is it a first class miracle? And the distinction came down to this. He says, can someone who is not breathing then begin to breathe again without any sequelae or without any consequences, without any negative effects? Well, yeah, I mean, that can happen. A person can, you know, and that could be miraculous if they have a long deprival of oxygen, long deprivation of oxygen, and yet, you know, continue with normal health. In this case, though, the length of time, the question is, was this just simply restoration of health, or was this raising the dead? That was the question. And if at any point in time they had pronounced the child actually dead, and then the child came back to life, that would have been first class. But there was never any medical moment at which there was a pronouncing the time of death. So instead, all the doctors could agree it was certainly third class without a doubt, but it was possibly first class, but in any case, it passed unanimously as a third class miracle, but could have been, in the opinion of some, even a first class miracle. So just a quick aside on this kind of fascinating detail, I think, about miracles. So and so then this just brings to a conclusion the presentation. Just once again, for people who are interested, if my doctoral thesis is available, if people do want to delve through that, and then this presentation itself, if you're interested in following along. So on my website at jgray.org and then /saints.pdf, this material is all available. So if you want to go back to review any of the information that was contained in this presentation, it's all readily there and accessible if that's of help to anyone in your cases. It's when working on causes of saints, you never know who's going to get involved. If you're trained in canon law, you're pretty sure that you're probably going to be working on annulments. You can guarantee that. But whether a case for canonization drops in your lap or not is sometimes one you can't entirely anticipate or expect. But if anyone here does in fact have the privilege of working on those cases, it is really a wonderful area of canon law to work in, and I'm happy to do a part to share some expertise in this area. So thank you very much.